The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome everybody to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Enjoying a nice cool morning here in Colorado as we record this. I promise we won't talk too much about the weather in this show, though. Pretty standard Q&A show coming up today. Got, I'm sure, a couple of Social Security-based questions and then a variety of other things that Jim's going to bring to the show. Nothing super exciting happening on my end other than school's back in session. So classes have started at Colorado State University. Lots of universities around the country are in the same situation. College football, I think, has got a new form of excitement. I personally don't like the new mobility of players that have been bought aspect of it, but it does create an interesting thing where you never know what the heck you're going to get every year because so much of the team turns over. So it'll be interesting to see starting this weekend how some of the teams work out and if they're living up to expectations, we'll call it. But other than that, not much going on my end. So Jim, hopefully your garden's probably loving this weather. You're like, oh my gosh, I've been transported back to garden heaven.
Thank you, Chris, for the intro, and welcome everybody to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. I am Jim Salnier. A correct pronunciation, according to my dad, my late dad, was Saulnier. And every once in a while, I'll come across someone who speaks French, especially Canadian French, because we're from Montreal, and they'll pronounce it Saulnier. So I'm Jim Saulnier, and you just heard Chris Steine. Is that how we would say it?
No normal person would say it like that. But
Chris Stein and Jim Saulnier, if you will, of the Retirement IRA Show. But yes, new listeners might not know what Chris is talking about, but yours truly is a gardening fan. And he has been complaining for the last 26 years on how hot and dry Colorado is. And for the last 2 weeks, like a light switch, folks, we were having a very hot summer, and it was in the 90s, and then all of a sudden a light switch flicked. Next day it was in the 70s, and we haven't left, and it's been, gosh, going on almost 2 weeks now. We're going to hit low 80s this holiday weekend, so I do want to wish everybody a happy Labor Day weekend if you're listening to this over the weekend. If it's after Labor Day weekend when you listen to this, I hope you had a nice Labor Day weekend. But I think it's almost nationwide, Chris. I watch the weather a lot now in Ohio, and they've only been in the 70s as well and pleasant. So I don't know if it's just kind of a shift. What has me concerned, though, folks, for those who don't know, in addition to Colorado being hot and dry most of the time, it's a high plains desert. At night, deserts get cold. And we can literally, beginning the first week of September, and it happened just a few years ago, 5 years ago actually now, a cold snap came in the first week of September for 2 days, dropped the temperatures into the 20s at night, and killed my entire garden. So anywhere between next week And when I do my big harvest around the second, third week of October, I can lose my garden at any time. That is frustrating here in Colorado. So now, as odd as this sounds, I'm rooting a little bit more, folks and Chris, for the harder weather to come back at least for a couple more weeks. Not back into the 9,500 degree range, but maybe a little bit warmer because the nights are getting chilly. Have you noticed?
It's nice. I know. I like it. Yeah. But I could do without all the humidity. It's kind of muggy. So I like low 80s with partly cloudy and no rain. That's me.
That's you. Yeah. Okay. All right, folks. Anyways, I digress. Let's skip and get to the task at hand, which is answering some questions that you guys send in. Literally, I have no idea what we're going to answer today, except for the Social Security questions, which I'm trying to find. And as Chris is going over the Social Security questions, I'm going to look and try to find some non-Social Security questions to answer. All righty, so let's get to Chris's Social Security questions first. If I can find my Social Security folder, there we go. All righty. Are you ready, Chris?
I am ready.
All right, let's see if they give a hint. Bup. No hint. She just comes out and says, I live in California. So no hint for California, folks. All righty. Says, hi, Jim and Chris and the rest of the staff. I continue to be a faithful listener of everything you share with us. I find it valuable. I have a layered question on the timing of Social Security. For a little background, in April of next year, so that'll be 2026, folks, April 30th of 2026, I will turn 70. I live in California and will put my home up for sale in the spring of 2026. So right around the time that this woman is going to reach 70, folks, in California, she's going to sell her home. She thinks the home will sell between June and July of next year. So I guess it's a strong housing market of where she is in California. When I sell my California home, I'm going to move to Scottsdale, Arizona to join my family. Well, I hope you like hot, dry weather, listener. Okay. Questions as I'm confused about my timing. Is it true that if I apply to have my Social Security start April 30th, that it's mandatory that I have to sign up for Part B at the time of the Social Security application? And Part B, she's talking Medicare, folks. Is it mandatory that I have to sign up for Part B at the time of my Social Security application, even if I haven't quit working and will still be on full Kaiser benefits? She works for Kaiser, folks. Or, for less Social Security application confusion, can I sign up for Social Security when I sell my house and indicate that I'm requesting benefits to begin starting back on April 30th of 2026? And then I would sign up for Part B on purpose at the same time. I'm not keen on forfeiting any Social Security payments, so I'm curious to see if Social Security would catch me up on my payments back to April 30th of 2026 without any issues, such as waiting for these back payments. I have no problem with whatever the rules are, as I can easily pivot with my plan. I just can't seem to find this how this scenario should be addressed. Thanks for all you do. I think she's running into, first of all, does her employer provide, I guess, the proper coverage? You can address that. I don't know if that applies here or not. And back payments, those 6 months retro payments. Yeah. I think she's got a few moving parts here.
Yeah, I think she's close in her understanding, I think, but just needs a few modifications. So first of all, when you apply for Social Security retirement benefits, you are, if you are of Medicare age, age 65, you are required and forced to sign up for Medicare Part A only. A is what they call hospital insurance. It's the part not many people pay much attention to, because as long as you're fully insured with Social Security, you've contributed long enough, the Part A premiums are free to you, so you don't kind of notice it. But it is Part A that, for whatever reason, in the rules, in the law, you have to be enrolled in Part A if you are of Medicare age and collecting Social Security. So I think she's heard that there's this mandatory thing, but it isn't Part B. Part B is technically voluntary. The only penalty for not signing up for Part B is that if you sign up later than you are eligible for Part B, then there's a lifetime penalty in the form of increased premiums for the rest of your life, in the form of 10% higher premiums for each year you didn't enroll when you should have. But if you could go through your whole life without ever signing up for Part B. So Part B is not mandatory. So that's what's going on. So if she's still working, and I suspect this is an issue she has employer-based healthcare. Jim didn't mention that, so I'm going to make that assumption. Otherwise, she'd already be on Medicare at this point, right? If she's turning 70 next year,
I didn't mean to interrupt. Mm-hmm. I did skip that part to try to be brief. You know me, I'm very brief, pithy, to the point. Mm-hmm. So I skipped that part. She says, current health insurance is with Kaiser. I will sign up for original Medicare at retirement. I'm already signed up for Medicare Part A. I probably should have said that earlier.
Oh, yeah. So she's already got Part A, which she would, if she didn't have that when she went to file for Social Security, she would be forced to sign up for that as well. But for her, that's a moot point. She's already on it. But they're not going to force her onto Part B. So she will be able to have a start date for Social Security benefits in April when she turns 70. But she can then also put in an application for Medicare to start the month after she comes off of her qualified employer plan. The reason she's only on A at this point, I'm assuming, is that she's got qualifying coverage from her employer that allows her to not sign up for Part B and then eventually go on to Part B when she retires, which is her plan, without then incurring that 10% per year penalty for not signing up back at 65. So that's one of the ways you get out of the penalty, is you maintain creditable coverage during the time period of 65 until you do sign up, which happens a lot when people continue to work and have an employer-based plan. So that sounds like the scenario here. So her initial goal, I guess, can be achieved. But I want to address the second part because I want to clarify the she said, catch me up or make me whole kind of a situation. If you go in to apply for retirement benefits or spousal benefits or survivor benefits, if you are over your full retirement age, they don't allow you to do this if you're under. If you're under your full retirement age, you cannot claim retroactively. But once you've reached your full retirement age, if you go months past that, they'll let you file your application, make it effective retroactively, back up to 6 months or back to your full retirement age, whichever is less. So she's well past her full retirement age, so that's not an issue. That's not a limiter. The 6 months is a limiter. So if she were to go past April, where she intended to collect benefits, maybe she forgot to file or whatever, that's really the reason why they give you this 6 month option, is that if you intended to file and something happened and you didn't, let's kind of have a do-over attempt, if you will. But if she did choose to go past it, she could ask for them to date it retroactively, but it's limited to 6 months. So if she went 5 years past her age 70 and then filed, they wouldn't say, oh, yeah, you missed out on it. You should have filed back when you were 70 because your benefits don't increase anymore for waiting. We'll pay you for the 5 years you've missed. That does not happen. It's limited to 6 months retroactive payments. So they would do that, but I think that's because you can do what you initially wanted, which is sign up for Social Security in April, but make your Medicare effective in August or whenever it is you are going to retire and come off of your employer plan, that you can do in your scenario. You just need to make sure that you do the applications for both of those things in such a way that requests that Social Security benefit starting in April, and then your Medicare Part B and any supplements and those types of things you're going to sign up for start in the month that you want to start them. So when you actually retire, based on your description. So hopefully that helps clarify it. Again, I think she was pretty close in her understanding, but just a couple of things that weren't quite right.
Alrighty. I think that awkward pause was my cue to produce the second question.
Yes.
Alrighty. I think that was a good answer. Nothing that I want to add. Not that I add much on Social Security, because you do such a good job on it. Okay. Kind of makes sense of his state hint.
His state hint stumps you?
Well, it's not very well worded. I think he should have worded it a little. Well, no, I see what he's saying. I'll read it, and then I think we're going to have to explain it. If you're a football fan, you'll get it. He says, my state hint, this is for you now. Ironically, only one NFL football team plays its home games in this state. That could be any of the 32 teams. Well, not quite, if you see how what he's... I understand what he's saying. I think a better way of putting it, and it narrows your choices down. If you know football, it's going to greatly narrow this down to just a couple of potential states. It should say, my state has more than one NFL football team. And ironically, I'm in the state where only one of the multiple teams play their home games in my state. Now, if you know football, you got to like a one out of three, maybe one out of four. I'm trying to do the math in my head. I think it's a one out of one, two, three. No, one out of four chance of getting this.
Well, I think the one that pops to mind is New York, because they have that goofy situation where two of the three teams play in New Jersey for their home games, and it's only Buffalo that plays in its actual home state. I don't think there's any others. There's certainly other states that have multiple NFL teams.
I think there's five states with multiple NFL teams.
But I don't think any of them play outside their home state. So,
You're right. New York was his answer, and he did point out two of the teams, the Jets and the Giants, actually play in New Jersey. And I think it's New York, Ohio, Florida, Texas, and California that have multiple NFL teams. I'm trying to think in my head if there's a sixth state. There could be, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. But I know Ohio, New York,
so. And I don't think any of them have that weird situation where they built their stadium in a different
state. Where they play
state.
In other states. Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly, so. So anyways, it was just, I get what he was trying to say. Could have been worded a little bit better. Let's hope his question makes more sense than his state hint for you.
Okay.
My father applied for spousal Social Security on an ex-spouse's records. Not one of, just ex-spouse. I misspoke. My father applied for spousal Social Security benefits on an ex-spouse's record. He did so in early 2025, simply because I was listening to your show during the GPO and WEP elimination. He also got one of his friends to apply. My father did start receiving his monthly benefit in the correct amount, and his friend received the monthly benefit in the correct amount. His friend was a widower, and Social Security gave him 6 months retroactive. My father applied for his 6 months retroactive, and they denied him. Would there be any reason why he would have been denied? They were married for more than 10 years and have been divorced for more than 8. I was expecting both of them. I think he's talking about his father and his father's friends. I was expecting both of them to be able to get all the way back to January of 2024. Do you have any thoughts on why they didn't go back to January of 24 and why my father was not even able to get the 6 months retroactive? My father is 75, his ex-spouse is 70, and she just started her benefits in January. Social Security Administration said that he couldn't go back further than the time when she claimed. However, that doesn't track for an ex-spouse. I think this, I know that you're probably sitting there saying, didn't we just answer a question like that? Listeners might be saying that, and you might be saying that, Chris. But I just thought it's another confusing thing, and maybe we're going to keep running into this. But again, I too am getting a little confused here because there's the normal retroactive benefits, if you will, but he specifically called out the elimination of WEP and GPO. So I'm guessing the father or somehow was going to be subject to WEP and GPO, so never bothered applying for benefits because he wouldn't have gotten them. And then after the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else passed, and he was going to be able to get a spousal or survivor benefit, he applied. And the listener is probably thinking, well, gee, I thought he was going to be able to go all the way back to January of 2024 and get all of that money, but he was denied that. But for some reason, it also seems he was denied the quote-unquote normal retroactive benefits, whereas his friend, and I'm guessing his friend wasn't subject to WEP or GPO, seemed to have gotten the 6 months retro. Anyways, that's my interpretation of the email. But again, this came from the gentleman who had a poorly worded state hint. So is there anything missing that you would
Well, the
need
way
to know?
When you read it to me, it sounded like both of them were in the same boat, that both of them had GPO, so hadn't filed. And his friend went in and filed for survivor benefits, and he went in and filed for ex-spouse benefits because his ex-spouse is still alive.
Oh, okay. That's another way of looking at it. Yeah.
So they gave his friend the 6 months retroactive. There's two elements here. Let me first address what we just talked about recently, which is, although the Social Security Fairness Act, which is the official name, became applicable or effective January 1st of 2024, Congress unfortunately did not include an override to the normal 6 month retroactive claiming rules. So that means if you claimed in early 2025, you don't get to retroactively claim all the way back to January of 2024 because that's, you know, over a year, over your 6 months, certainly. So you're still going to be playing by the 6 month rule. Some people who had filed for a benefit that was simply reduced because of WEP and, or GPO, excuse me, they were effectively receiving benefits, even if that benefit was close to zero or zero. They actually had an application live in the system, and those people, even after contacting Social Security at this point in 2025, would be made whole all the way back to January of 2024, because in the eyes of the Social Security Administration, they were underpaying them that whole time, and they're fixing a problem. If there's an underpayment issue, there is no 6 month limit on that. It's deemed an error. But if you hadn't filed yet, you don't have an active application in, then you are limited to that 6 month retroactive. So that's why his friend only went back 6 months. Now, the second issue is filing for spousal benefits when you are divorced. So he mentioned the key factor. They had been married more than 10 years before becoming divorced. If you're married 10 years or longer, they measure it right to your anniversary day. You are treated for claiming a spousal benefit as if you were still married effectively. Now, normally, so if they were still married, it is true that to claim a spousal benefit on someone else's record, that person must have filed for their benefit themselves. We call it unlocking the door to the spousal benefit. So if they were still married, his wife would have had to claim, which he mentioned she claimed she had turned 70 and just claimed here in January of 2025. If they were still married, he wouldn't be able to claim a spousal benefit back past that date. But because they were divorced more than 2 years, Once you've been divorced more than 2 years after being married 10, they waive that rule, that requirement that your spouse had to have claimed to unlock the door. The door is unlocked for you to claim the spousal benefit when you're divorced 2 years. So he was divorced 8, he said. So I believe that Social Security has made a mistake and he should go back and appeal that decision, ask for a review. And I think he will, in fact, then get the 6 months retro. He will not get it back to January of 2024 for the reasons I already mentioned. But given the facts as laid out to me in what Jim read from the email, I believe Social Security has made a mistake, especially if they told him specifically that it was because they couldn't go back farther than when she claimed. That is patently wrong for ex-spouse benefits. That's just not how they work. So if they told him that is the reason, then this will easily be overturned, because anyone in Social Security with somewhat advanced knowledge will know. And when it gets reviewed by that person, they'll override this, I believe, immediately. So there you go. A couple of things in there to clarify.
Okay, sorry again with the awkward pause. I was getting all the emails together that I want to get to. I think I'm being way, way overly optimistic on how many emails I want to get through. If you saw how many I have opened on my computer screen, you'd laugh your butt off and say, there's no way you're going to get to all those, Jim. And I probably won't.
Okay. Well, we'll give it a try.
We can see what happens. Yeah. We can see what happens. But, all right. Couple of things I did notice that we've got just over the past week, so we'll probably address each of them in order of their appearance. Criticisms. Three huge criticisms in a row. I didn't realize we got that many in. Two directed against me, which is nothing new there, folks. If anyone's going to get criticized, it's always me. And then one against you, so which is pretty good. Thank you, listener, for criticizing Chris as well. First criticism, I guess this one could technically be driven to you as well, but he addresses it to me. And anyways, I'm going to go through with this, folks, because what the hell? It's my show, so we'll do it. Good evening, Jim. This request is rooted in the basis of good intention, best intentions, so I hope it comes across that way. I enjoy your format and content and rank this podcast as one of the best retirement planning informational sources. Well, thank you, listener, for that. And a little bit of banter is great. An occasional deep dive into the rabbit holes is fine. But your use of ChatGPT into your discussions is sucking the life out of your show. Many of us already use these AI tools on a regular basis, and we appreciate all the benefits they bring us, and we appreciate the limitations of AI. But your recent banter with AI and with Chris moves to a point and then moves on. I don't know what he means by that. Moves forward to a point and then moves on. I'm just not sure how much more you stopping and asking Chris questions and comparing Chris's answer with Chat's answer and then having an extended discussion between the two of you of Chat's misinterpretations, how much more of this we can handle. Chris and you know what you're talking about. You have a good pace, and even the occasional rabbit hunting, we learn from you and enjoy being part of your lives. Please stop using chat before you lose us. I actually am going to disagree with this listener politely, as his email was polite. First of all, the use of chat was removed from the show. We were using chat to do the state hints, and many people, one woman started it, and even though her email was a little stern to me, I admitted she was right, and we removed it. The use of chat on these answers to the Ed Slot test, which is a regular part of the EDU show that we do, was specifically made by a listener's recommendation. So here is a classic case. I can't please everybody. One person wanted and specifically asked to use chat against Chris on the Ed Slot test, and this person is saying to get rid of it. So I'm asking people to just understand this is kind of our show, but we have to please a multitude of people, not just you.
Yeah. And we're not going to do chat like every, something. You know, the last two EDU shows we did it because we were playing that quiz game with the Ed Slot quiz.
Yeah, we're not
going
to use it again.
But we're not going to do that regularly. That's not a, now that we've stopped doing it for the state hints, we're not going to be having chat come up in most of the shows. It'll be kind of an occasional little thing, maybe like the Ed Slot quiz or something like that.
I liked it for the Ed Slot quiz, and that's why I wanted to read this, and I'm asking for people to share their thoughts. The reason I liked it, it was kind of like having another employee on who was sharing their thoughts. An employee who was wrong a lot of times wouldn't be someone working for us. But it was like having a junior planner on or an intern who's just kind of learning this. Smart, but occasionally wrong. It allowed Chris and I to do what we do on that Ed Slot test is, yes, try to see if you guys, as you listen, and Chris, as he is asked the question, can get them right. I shared that on this last one, I got 3 of the 20 wrong. I'm not perfect either. We all are going to make mistakes. But then we learn from them. And that's what Chris and I are trying to do, is then dive deeper into the reasoning behind the question. And that's where I found chat quite valuable, because in defense of chat, it gave us some very good descriptions of why these rules applied or why the answers worked. It just made some wrong ones as well, and it allowed us to dive deeper in and get a better understanding. So my thought is I'll continue to probably do the Ed Slot test that way, and that's only twice a year, every 6 months, because I found it enjoyable and hopefully beneficial, because it's not just having an Ed Slot question and move on to the next one. That bores the hell out of me. It's getting deeper into some of the answers and teaching you guys some of the nuances that were being covered, as we did, and we spent a lot of time through the Ed Slot on the mandatory Rothification, if you will, of catch-up contributions beginning next year. So anyways, I just wanted to address that one. Then there's one that I need to apologize, I guess, to you on, Chris. I won't read her a whole email, but she was offended when I asked, when was the last time your bulbous butt went on a horse? She felt I should not have used bulbous butt in the description of your posterior, is what they call it. I don't know. I know what I'm supposed to call it. I thought bulbous butt was a cute little way of saying it. But she was right that that could have been construed as offensive. And I did not mean to offend you. So if you got offended to it, I would like to publicly apologize.
I recall you asking about getting on a horse, but somehow I didn't hear the bulbous butt part, so I wasn't offended until now. And now,
now you're going to pretend being offended. Okay.
But
this listener is Georgette from California. Mm-hmm. Point taken, Georgette. Yeah. I will not refer to Chris's posterior. Is that how you say it? Posterior?
Sure.
As a bulbous butt. It's actually quite a cute one. It's severe.
Well, let's not go that direction either.
I've checked it out.
Thanks for
it's not bad.
Thanks for sticking up for me, listener. Appreciate it.
Signed, Chris's mom. No. Okay, now the next one. This one is actually kind of a good one. She disagrees with the way we said things, but well, let's get to it and you'll see. This one actually has to do with retirement planning. The other two were more show related. Okay. First, let me give you my state quiz. Of the 48 contiguous states, this one has the most lighthouses. I don't think you're going to get this, because the first state that popped into my head is not the answer.
I thought we had this one before, maybe. The most lighthouses.
In the lower 48.
Wow. Maine.
That's what popped into my head.
Florida.
Maine. Okay, I'll take this one step further. You are partially correct.
Partially.
You got the first letter of the state.
Maryland?
Partially correct. You've got the first letter of the state.
Minnesota?
Partially correct. How many? You're running out of states that begin with M, Chris. Michigan.
Really?
Oh, I guess because of the Great Lakes.
I guess.
We don't proof these questions, folks, but Michigan, I thought Maine as well, because you always, when I think of lighthouses, I think of the coast of Maine.
Yeah, me too. Well, okay. Interesting. Yeah, see, fun fact on the show.
All right, this goes back to EDU 2533. So that was a couple weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I disagree with the comment you made in funding discretionary spending in EDU show 2533. You said you won the game. Why take the risk? Once you have Social Security, annuities, Roth IRAs, long-term care policies, and all of your minimum dignity floor and fund spending are covered with all of those, then the balance of your account can be used for crazy expenses, like maybe a second home or a boat or very high-end trips, traveling first class, or giving money to friends and family and charities. To say, quote unquote, you won the game is correct, but to say, why take the risk is incorrect. Personally, we're not interested in conservative bonds or low growth stocks for that remaining balance. Based on our health, we think we will have a long time, and we want that extra money that we're not using to be invested in 70 to 80% stocks. Sure, it's risky, but the rewards would be so much greater. If you factor 3% inflation over the next 30 years, we may even need some of that extra balance for ourselves, even though right now we don't. So we want it to grow more than inflation, or 3%. Mm-hmm. Soon, we're going to start a monthly giving with a warm hand gift to our children, and we're going to do it from our Roth IRA. And we're going to make larger 501c3 donations from our traditional IRA. She's talking QCDs there, folks, I would assume, qualified charitable distributions. We will be calculating these amounts every year so that by age 100, the balances in both those IRAs, the Roth and the traditional, will be zero. So I think this listener, folks, and I'll let Chris speak for himself, because he said that or something, or maybe we both did. I can't remember who said
that. No, I remember saying it. And
okay. Yeah. So in this particular case, this woman is almost what we call a unicorn. She made it perfectly clear that her Social Security, I don't know if I made this part clear, annuities inside her Roth IRA, LTC policies, which she also said are paid off, cover her entire minimum dignity floor and fund spending. So if she has Social Security, annuities, and a paid off LTC policy, and right now she doesn't need the excess money, that's totally different than the situation Chris and I were discussing. And we referenced that into the show because we had just met as a team. We do all our retirement planning as a team on Tuesdays. And I think I even referenced, hey, Chris, we had a similar situation to this. And Jake worded it as he's going to talk to the people. You won the game and you finished, you know, why take the risk? So a couple of things before I let Chris chime in, and I promise you, Chris, you can chime in. We are financial planners. We have to look at things differently. And we were specifically referencing what we were going to tell someone who was paying us for our advice. I'm the chief compliance officer for my firm. It bores the heck out of me, compliance, because it's all legal stuff. If I wanted to do that, I would have became an attorney. I work closely with our compliance attorney. I work closely with our compliance consultant. Thankfully, I have an attorney and a consultant. They're my next to labor. Those two are my biggest expense. I keep pointing that out to them constantly. That said, we couldn't tell people oh, just go ahead and invest 80% in equities, we would have to make sure they feel comfortable and their risk tolerance is there. And the people we were discussing specifically in the office did not have, in our opinion, the risk tolerance to take that risk. And we were going to point out to them, they don't need to. They won the game. Why take the risk? A lot of retirement planning isn't just dying with the most. And that's not what you're advocating here, listener. I get that. You're going to try to die with zero by giving it all away to your children from a Roth and to charity as a QC, as a QCD. But when we say you won the game, why take the risk? Part of what we want to do is encourage people to spend, especially on fun, which is very easy for people to convince themselves in times of market or economic turmoil not to do. And then sadly, they might become the quote unquote other guy. And all of a sudden, what they put off to allow the economy or the markets to come back and allow them from an emotional standpoint to feel comfortable spending on fun, in that time frame, they can no longer spend on fun because they became the other guy. Maybe they got diagnosed with a medical condition, had a stroke like I did 5 years ago, whatever the or die outright. And whatever the case may be, they cannot enjoy themselves. So we have to, as we work, and sometimes we talk on the show as if we're talking to employees also in the industry, we have to be very careful when we make investment recommendations because we can be held liable. So sometimes we do tell people, you have enough, you don't need to take the risk. And if they then override us like you would, if you were a client of ours and say, hey, no, we want to, fine, perfect. But we would document that in writing and we would make sure that, hey, yes, we told them they didn't have to take this risk. They said they were comfortable with it. Here's the email exchange. They gave us the approval. That helps us from a liability standpoint. So sometimes on the show, we don't dive into that, but I want you guys to understand it. We're not talking heads like Susie Orman and Dave Ramsey and the others. They're not practicing financial planners. God, if they were, they'd be terrible. But they're great at marketing and they've been great at being able to say whatever the heck they want because they don't actually have clients. We have to operate in a different realm. So she was, again, inserting her situation into something that didn't apply to her situation. And we were talking about something different. Go ahead, Chris. You can clarify it as well.
Yeah. So when I say that, that's kind of the short version. And it's probably the expanded version is you've won the game. Why take the risk if it makes you feel uncomfortable? And that's really striking a lot at what you were describing, listener, that you're obviously comfortable taking risk and knowing that you have all this other stuff kind of handled with other resources actually in your minds gives you greater risk tolerance. So you're likely to take greater risk than you otherwise might with that quote, extra money that you're talking about. And it's right. If you are willing to do that, it is likely, not guaranteed, but likely over time that extra that you've got is going to grow and allow you to do more of that extra stuff. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. My point was there's some people that are, have kind of put up with risk, right? They've accepted it as something they have to do in order to reach their goals. And then there's a point where they actually have accumulated enough where if they're in that uncomfortable, if their risk tolerance is such where they wish they could be safer, saying you've won the game, you don't have to take the risk anymore. If you don't want to, you certainly can, like Jim said. So that's really what I was talking about. It wasn't a blanket. If you've got plenty of money, then you should just, you know, go for zero return to be safe. That's not what I was, you know, trying to get everybody to take away from that. That extra part, I might say regularly, if I repeat that again, because I have said that in the past, right? That's something that comes up. We run across people every now and again that have, we look at what their goals are in retirement. We look at their resources and it becomes pretty evident. They've got more resources than would ever be likely needed, to accomplish all their goals and more. So that's what we mean by kind of won the game. They can do what they want for the rest of their lives. That's kind of what I envision winning the game sounds like. And if you've done that and you can achieve all of that without reaching for return, which comes with risk, if that risk makes you feel uncomfortable, knowing that are in a position you don't have to do that can be quite comforting. And some people then play it that way. They're not in, they don't have the same mindset that you do.
Yeah, perfect. I like that. And it was a great question, listener.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you got to also, everybody now, not just this listener, our approach to retirement planning, the concept of what we call the secure retirement income process, of covering your minimum dignity floor expenses, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses through lifetime guaranteed income and not withdrawals from portfolios, that's all designed to help overcome what, for most people listening to this show, your biggest risk isn't going to be outliving your money. For most people, it's going to be not spending on fun during the last phase of your life. And that's a risk that's overlooked. The financial media doesn't talk about it, probably because it doesn't apply to over half or more of the U.S. population. But we don't work with everybody. Most financial advisors don't. We being collectively the industry, generally work those who actually are doing advice and not just an uncapped AUM management thing. But those who actually give retirement planning advice, those who actually specialize in distribution planning, like my firm does. When we work with someone, those people who are hiring us have the assets. They need the help. So it's not that, oh my God, the majority of our clients, oh God, they're going to outlive their assets. It's not. Now, we occasionally come across, I say occasionally, probably more often than we would prefer, sadly, but we do come across sometimes people who have been successful, but their lifestyle greatly exceeds their amount of assets. And yes, I would say probably 6 times or less a year, but somewhere around 6, we come across people that is going to be a difficult conversation, because they're not expecting the information we're going to give them that, gee, it does look like you could run out of money. But for most of the people we work with, running out isn't their greatest risk, and it's not really why they're working with us. It's because they want to spend on fun, and they're god-awfully afraid of doing it because they're freaking out. I've said that before. When you retire, you're going to freak out. And we work with people with $2 million, $3 million, $4 million, $5 million, $6 million of assets often. And they're freaking out. It's rational or irrational, but understandable. They just need some reassurance and some guidance. And often that caveat, you won the game, why take the risk, is about managing their emotional risk. So I can be comfortable that they're going to spend on fun. I more often than I want to admit, we are dealing with clients going through medical and aging related issues. Right now in the office, a cognitive decline of a wonderful person, and we're not quite sure if it is or isn't. That's about as deep as I want to get into this. But it saddens me because I know this person well. And we see this constantly. I don't want you guys, you do-it-yourselfers, you Vanguard VGers, to be the Debbie Downers that my dad warned me about before his own passing. The people who had money in his retirement community, my dad didn't. But these people do, who had money in the retirement community and were miserable because there was so much they could have, should have, would have done if they just did things differently, and they can't, and they spend the last years of their life with regrets. He called them Debbie Downers. So we often will implore people from an emotional standpoint. You seem to have a high risk tolerance, listener. And I've been in this industry 26 years. Y'all have high risk tolerances when you're in the middle of an expanding market. We haven't had a meaningful correction. And when I say meaningful, one that lasted more than 6 or 7 months before it fully recovered. We haven't had a 2008. We haven't had a 2000, 2001, 2002 period since then. We've had quote-unquote legal academic definitions of correction, 20% or more. We had one during COVID. Lasted a walloping 3 months. Woohoo! That was a tough one, huh? Oh my God, had to go 3 months before my portfolio rebounded. We haven't experienced the 1960s through early 70s phase of about 12 to 15 years of essentially no growth in the market. But that doesn't mean you won't in the future. And we have to guard against that. And we have to guard against the irrationality of people with assets freaking out because they're going down. Mostly because you guys have instilled in your heads that your portfolios are designed to be nurtured and protected and grown and never consumed. And this notion of spending from principal is archaic to you. These are the people who generally work with us. Like, hey, Jim, I don't think I'm going to outlive my money, but let's look at things. Help me put a plan in place. I want to protect my minimum dignity floor with guaranteed payments. So as I age and lose the cognitive functions, like sadly someone you might be dealing with now, I know my payments are going to come in and protect my other spouse who's not into this. But knowing I have that bottomless cup of coffee will help me feel comfortable spending my assets. Even though I have all this money, I'm still loath to spend it. Help me. That's kind of the people who work with us, folks. So oftentimes, some of the potential cure is, why take the risk? And if we can, from an emotional standpoint, get them to feel comfortable, gee, my portfolio's not moving too much. Okay, I feel fine spending on fun, even though things are down right now. I'm not going to put them off in the hopes when things come back, I then spend on fun and run the risk that I'm the other guy during that time period, and now I become a Debbie Downer. So there's a reasons behind why we say a lot of this. So I know I dove deep into that, but again, folks, I'm trying to get you to think of retirement planning beyond return on your assets. It's a return of your assets. And that's a huge difference, substituting an F for the N in that two-letter word. And it's often the return of the assets that's more important for people who are consuming from an emotional standpoint. Okay. Here is a good one for National Annuity Awareness Month. We've got to get to an annuity question. It's a pretty straightforward one, but one that I think a lot of you aren't going to know. Says, hey, I have an idea for National Annuity Awareness Month. I am part of a religious denomination with a historical connection to a very large investment and insurance company. I like how this person says, I'm not going to call him out, he says. He didn't tell me. I know who he's talking about. I'm sure you guys will know who he's talking about. Where did I leave off? A very large investment and insurance company. This company is classified as a fraternal society. Recently, I saw this verbiage in one of the documents of theirs that they sent me. And I'm going to read, quote unquote, right from the document, folks. Unlike commercial insurers, this gentleman specifically has redacted the name of this insurance company. So I will continue to redact it. But you guys can figure this out. So we'll call it XYZ Insurance Company. Unlike commercial insurers, XYZ Insurance Company, as a fraternal benefit society, is not in the State Insurance Guarantee Association. This means that XYZ Insurance Company cannot be assessed for the insolvency of other life insurers. By law, XYZ Insurance Company is responsible for its own solvency. Like other fraternal benefit societies, if XYZ insurance company's reserves were to become impaired, the policyholders may be assessed a proportionate share of the impairment. But any values in subaccounts where the policyholders bear investment risk will not be assessed. End quote. I thought this would be an interesting subject for you to talk about, Jim. Sincerely, we'll call him George from Alabama. This gentleman is pointing out a lot here. Fraternal benefit societies which offer insurance are not part of state guarantee associations. They receive no state guarantee protections. I'm kind of smiling at the wording of what this insurance company is saying. Mm-hmm. You have to understand what they're saying and how they're saying it for you to be able to assess if that's a good thing or a bad thing. There is a few people, I know of one in particular, who wholesales insurance, and he predominantly, his company wholesales for only fraternals. And he uses the fact that they're fraternals as a positive because they're not in the state guarantee association. Others, I'd say the majority of the industry, say that is not a positive, it's a negative, because it exposes policyholders to insolvency risk. That risk is not being pooled and collectivized across the entire insurance industry. It's being carried only by the members of that fraternal organization, and they're bearing the risk amongst themselves. So they use it as a negative. Is it a positive or is it a negative? That's up to you to decide. But it's very important to understand fraternals. And this particular fraternal this gentleman from Alabama is talking about is massive and very well funded. But yes, technically speaking, it could run into issues. And the state is not going to bail them out. So let's go through this little disclosure. Unlike commercial insurers, XYZ Insurance Company is a fraternal benefit society and is not in the State Insurance Guarantee Association. I just said that. Fraternal benefit societies, by law, are not covered by state guarantee associations. I've often said the verbiage state guarantee association is Orwellian. Why is that, Chris?
Because it's not actually an explicit guarantee by the state to 100% protect what is being covered. It's a attempt to collectively, as you know, kind of provide a backing for these insurance companies. But it's the word guarantee, especially in an insurance industry context, I'm surprised they use that word.
I should say the State Potential Protection Guarantee Association. I didn't even put the word guarantee in. I agree. So Chris is spot on. I often say it's an Orwellian term because if you go to any of the 50 State Guarantee Associations website, the first thing they tell you is it's not guaranteed. But they're going to call it the Guarantee Associations. But it's a collective. Understanding what the State Guarantee Associations do is helpful. And we'll get to that. But that first sentence is true. Fraternals are not part of state guarantee associations. The next sentence, they're turning this into a positive. Whether it's positive or not is up for debate. If I had that gentleman that I was telling you who wholesales for fraternals, he would be saying, that's a positive. If you have the industry as a whole debating him, they would say, no, that's a negative. Because the policy holders of a state guarantee, excuse me, of a fraternal, just the policy holders bail each other out. They're not collectively sharing that risk across the entire state, if you will. And that's what insurance is, folks. It's risk pooling. inside a state guarantee association, excuse me, inside a fraternal, because they're not members of the state guarantee association, the pool to bail out insolvency, to bail out policyholders in insolvency, is just other policyholders. In a state guarantee association, it's the insurance industry bails out the weaker players. And people don't understand that. The state guarantee funds really don't have much, if any, money in them. What the state guarantee funds will do, if your insurance company is a member, it's non-fraternal, so they're in the state guarantee association, the state will assess all the insurance companies doing business in that state a fee based on their proportional representation of the insurance that's going under. What does that mean in English? If you have an annuity company going under, and it's an annuity company in a particular state, and the annuities need to be bailed out, the state will go to every insurance company in that state and see what percent of the total business of that state annuities is each insurance company. Let's say they say you are 10% of the annuity business in our state, you're 15, you're 3, you're 0.1. We need X number of millions to bail everybody out, so you have to put in your proportional share. You put in 1% of that amount, you got to put in 15 because you're 15% of the annuity business in this state. That's how it works. And then the insurance companies will pay those dollars into the state. The state will use those dollars to make the policyholders whole of the insurance company going under up to the limits of that particular state's liability. So the insurance companies are not collectively bailing out the policyholders to the fullest extent. They're only bailing them out to the limitations. Some states protect $100,000, most are $300,000, some are $250,000. Every state is different. So it's a collective funding, but the states only assess the fee on the insurance companies if a policy is going under. And if you're an insurance company and all that you do is property and casualty insurance and you don't sell annuities, you wouldn't have to put anything in to bail out an annuity company. Conversely, if a property and casualty insurer is going under and you just sell annuities, you don't have to bail out the property and casualty insurer. So let's get back to what this disclosure was saying. This means the fact that they're not in the State Guarantee Association, this means that XYZ insurance cannot be assessed for the insolvency of other life insurers. That is true because they're not a member of the society. They're a fraternal. Fraternals are exempt. So that part is true. And the gentleman who wholesales just fraternals, he would say that's a positive. That, hey, we, our insurers, don't have to bail out other bad actors. They just have to worry about themselves. I'm not quite sure if that's a positive or a negative. I'll leave that to you guys to decide. I continue with the disclosure. By law, XYZ Insurance Company is responsible for its own solvency. That's what I just said. So like other fraternal benefit societies, if XYZ's reserves became impaired, it's a nice way of saying we become insolvent. We don't have enough money to pay our claims. We're insolvent. The certificate, and it puts in parentheses, or policyholders may be assessed a proportionate share of the impairment. Let's pause there. What it's saying is, all you guys are going to have to bail each other out, a proportional share. So rather than in the state guarantee associations where the state handles all this and charges a proportional share, when a fraternal goes under, the state doesn't step in. So the fraternal, which is a membership organization, you if you're in the fraternal, you're a part of the membership. You're a member of the fraternal. You all bail each other out in a similar fashion. And you kind of determine, well, you're going to have to pay, it's not going to be 1, 2, or 3%. It's going to be 0.000%, and you pay 0.002%. They're just going to reduce what you have because they're going under. You guys are bailing everybody else out. They're going to collectively get it from the fraternal members if they can. The next part highlights the difference between a variable annuity and a fixed annuity. It goes on to say, but any values in subaccounts where the certificate or policyholder bears investment risk will not be assessed. We have said on this show many times, and it's important you understand this. When you buy an annuity, you or a life insurance policy, because you can have a variable policy or you can have a fixed policy, you have to know where your money goes. Is your money part of the general account of the insurance company, or is it held in separate sub-accounts? Every policy except variable policies, so every fixed policy, the money goes to the insurance company's general account. It's no longer yours, it's the insurance company's. And it is subject to the creditors and risks of the insurance company. When you buy a variable annuity or variable life insurance, your money, your excess money that's being invested in the variable accounts, the cost of insurance, that goes to the insurance company's general account. And you don't get that anyways because it's covering the cost of insurance. But any of your money that you have invested in the variable subaccounts, that money is protected. It's not the insurance company's. So you can have this fraternal XYZ company go under. But if you had a variable annuity with them and the variable annuity had $100,000 in it, they're not going to take a proportional share from your $100,000 to bail out the fraternal. They can't touch it. It's not part of their general account. It's protected. There's a Chinese wall between your 100,000 in my example in a variable annuity and the insurance company. But when you buy fixed annuities, MIGAs, fixed indexed annuities, to a degree, a RILA, a single premium median annuity, deferred income annuity, that's all to the risk of the insurance company. And that's why they all say, and you've seen this disclosure, the benefits in this policy are based on the claims paying ability of the issuing insurance company. And that's what this fraternal is saying. It's saying, hey, we're not going to take anything from the variable account, but if we go under, you as a member of this fraternal, therefore, a policy holder, your account balance will be debited a proportional share to bail out the insurance company, ergo bail out everybody. So in either situation, you're bearing some risk. Some will say a fraternal is better because the fraternal mothership company, not the policy holders, but the mothership company, they don't have to take any of their reserves and give it to the state to bail out an insurance company that's going under. Other people will say, no, you want that. You don't want policyholders bailing out a insurance company. That's too much risk to the policyholders. You want the state stepping in and having this guarantee account and assessing other insurance companies. And by default, most likely other well-capitalized companies that are not going under and have the reserves to pay into this bailout fund. You want the industry to bail out the weak players, not the policyholders. It's really going to be up to you to decide. I personally feel more comfortable with the state guarantee approach than a fraternal. However, this particular fraternal, and most of you will be able to figure out who it is, this, and I'm only not mentioning it because this person went out of their way not to mention it. I would have no problem with this fraternal. It is incredibly well funded, highly rated, highly respected, well funded, but it is not part of the state guarantee. I have seen other fraternals that make my skin curl. I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot frickin' pole. And why people put money with them to me is way too risky. But you can find that even in the non-fraternal world. There's some very well-funded ones and some that make my skin curl. So if you're buying a policy from someone, find out, is this a fraternal? Is it a non-fraternal? And then decide for yourself if you like the concept. Fraternals, policyholders are going to bail out the insurance company. State guarantee players, other insurance companies bail out the weakened insurance company. Who do you want doing the bailing out? Policyholders or the insurance company? That's what you have to decide. Anything you want to share, Chris?
No, I think it's good to know the distinction, just to know there's, I think there's nothing inherently good or bad about fraternal versus non-fraternal insurance companies, but the risk profile is a little different and they operate a little differently. You just have to know what you're getting into. That would be true of any insurance company. Anything that's unique to them, you should understand before buying a policy with that insurance company. So, good that people understand what they're getting.
Perfect. I thought so. Good question.
Yeah.
All right. One more quick question. I'll let you answer it so it'll go quick.
Okay.
I'll go to this one. It's kind of a planning question, but it has to do with Roths and 5-year rules. But we're not, it's a non-5-year rule question that does mention the 5-year rule. So don't people freak out on another 5-year rule. I'm going to let Chris handle this for two reasons. It's kind of a planning question. And if I try to do it, we'll be talking for another 20 minutes. All right. Hi, Jim and Chris. Love your show and the banter as well. Thank you, listener. Thank you for so much info every week. Now that I am over 59 and a half, and I have had my Roth for more than 5 years, do you think I should be using Roth conversions from my traditional IRA as a savings account? This question, Chris, kind of ties into our last Tuesday meeting where I was asking Jacob this specific question. Are you reviewing this with people? So it continues. Do you think it would make sense for me to determine what income I am comfortable with each year and then review my tax brackets and my IRMA situation? And rather than taking a withdrawal and putting the money in the bank, I take the money from my I he's talking from his IRA. I take the money from my IRA, but instead convert it to a Roth IRA. This will cover what I think I'm going to need for the year. I would then spend from my Roth IRA. I won't have to pay tax on any of the interest it's earning inside my Roth IRA. There will be no quote-unquote seasoning required in my strategy because I'm over 59 and a half and my Roth is more than 5 years old. I think this is more advantageous than just taking an IRA withdrawal and putting it in the bank. Because number one, I have to pay taxes on the interest that I'm earning in a high-yield savings account. We'll put high yield in quotation marks, folks, especially if they start cutting interest rates again. And if I don't need to spend all the money, it's no longer in a bank account, it's inside a Roth. What am I missing? Do you think this is a good idea? It seems to be a no-brainer to me. I thought I would ask you. Thanks for your help. I just saying, we do this a lot.
Yeah. There's nothing inherently wrong, and I think you've stumbled across something that we use pretty regularly, and that is, remember the short version of his scenario is he needs to take X amount of dollars out of his IRA.
He is a she. I should have mentioned it's a Georgette, not a George.
So they have to take X amount of dollars out of their IRA each year, and she is saying, don't just take it out and put it in the bank. Why don't I convert it? Even if I end up putting it in a bank account instead, a high yield savings account, which from an accumulator standpoint, they're like, why would you do that in a Roth? Roth is for growth. No, Roth is for all kinds of stuff. And one thing is having ready access to money that you can withdraw at any time without tax consequences. The taxes have already been paid once it's in there. So if you took that money out, put it in the Roth, I like the point of, if you don't spend it all, then it's in the Roth. If it turns out especially over several years, if you took out more and you're living, below that, then you would have the option of shifting all that into some investments for longer term growth. And it's in the Roth where all that growth will be tax free. If it was outside in a bank account and then built up, you couldn't say, oh, I've taken out over the last few years too much. I wish I could put this in the Roth. You can't. Because at that point, you can't contribute it back into the Roth. So I really like it. There is absolutely, some people think it's some kind of breaking some kind of commandment that you cannot just hold a bank account inside of a Roth. It could be every reason in the world to have really any kind of asset you might imagine in the Roth for a variety of reasons. So I'm a big fan of what he's talking about. We oftentimes refer to a pool of money that you can access without tax consequences as a liquidity account. That helps, we have found, people do annual tax kind of reconciliations, if you will, towards the end of the year, knowing how much to convert or withdraw or do something with that has a tax impact by throughout the year spending from money that doesn't generate taxes. So you have kind of a clean slate to do your reconciliation with late in the year. So having that money sitting in the Roth that you're taking out to pay your bills every month, no tax consequences during all that. And then at the end of the year, you do another conversion to an optimized tax bracket to refill it, or maybe more, right? Not that the only thing in the Roth would be this bank account. Obviously, you could have a Roth at the bank just for your liquidity account, and then a Roth that has more traditional investments for your long-term growth accounts as well. So, nothing wrong with what you're doing. And I actually really support it if that's, the place where you need to hold that liquidity account.
Remember, folks, retirement is the opposite of savings. Decumulation is the opposite of accumulation. Our firm specializes in decumulation. So much of the industry specializes in accumulation. In an accumulation mode, the notion of taking anything from a Roth is, no, you got to grow it. It's tax-free. It's one of the worst accounts to die with if you're leaving it to charity or if you have no children, no human you want to leave it to, because it means during your life you pay taxes to allow a portfolio to grow tax-free to only die and never get to use it. But even if you had people you want to leave the Roth to, we wholeheartedly support what this person is espousing. The only caveat I want to give is once she reaches RMD age, she didn't tell us her age, once she reaches just that she's over 59 and a half and a Roth is more than 5 years old and she's retired. Once you reach RMD age, you must take the RMDs first. Before doing the conversion strategy.
Right.
More often than not, at our practice, what we try to do and what I'm going to encourage you guys to try to do is have a liquidity account. And we mean liquidity in the sense you can turn it into cash instantly and there's no tax implication. It has to have both of those. So that's money in a bank and money in a Roth. That should be a liquidity account. And in a perfect world, you have more than enough to cover all of your expenses for the year, fund, minimum dignity floor, everything. And then every fall, this is what people don't think of, every fall in a distribution strategy, not accumulating anymore, you're distributing. You have money and always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. Some of you are working part-time. Some of you have consulting income or deferred comp. Some of you get inheritances. There's all sorts of weird things happening every year that makes it impossible to really predict what your tax situation for the year is going to be. So in January, if you had enough money to cover every conceivable, there's always exceptions, every conceivable expense for the year, just spend it from your liquidity account. Then in the fall, when you're 10, 11 months into the year, and you only have to estimate your income for another month or two, now you can do a damn accurate assessment. How much did I make for the year? What do my taxes look like right now? Gee, I only have 6 weeks left. What do I think I'm going to get in income for the next 6 weeks? You can get pretty damn accurate there, folks. You can now draw a picture of what your tax situation for this year is. Then you can look at your liquidity account and say, hey, there's more than enough money in this for next year as well. Maybe I'm going to do a big Roth conversion and just leave the money there. Maybe there's not enough liquidity and you're thinking, wow, I know I'm going to spend at least $80,000 next year. My minimum dignity floor alone is $55,000, and we have a $20,000 trip we're taking with our children. So I definitely want $80,000 in the bank, but I'm unsure of the rest. It looks like I can do this, and it looks like I can do that because of this. And maybe it makes sense to convert just $20,000 that year. We would ask, do you want to put that $80,000 in the bank, or do you want to put it in a Roth and do this strategy? Sometimes people say, well, let's put it in a Roth in case I don't do the trip. I mean, the minimum dignity floor, for sure, yes, I'm going to spend that. If I don't, it means I'm dead and the point is moot. So let's put the $55,000 in the bank. It's just easier for me. But yeah, that $20,000 that I think I'm going to spend on taking my family on a trip, there's always a chance we don't. Let's put that in the Roth. If I need it, leave it in cash or cash-like holding. We generally use a three-month laddered T-bill ETF. Leave it in that. If I need it, the Roth is already linked to my checking account. I'll transfer the money, no problem. So it's that type of planning that you need to do every fall. We call it a withdrawal analysis. Why? Because you're withdrawing money. So many people think they can do a plan with us, and we're going to tell them exactly how much to spend and withdraw, rather, from, well, first of all, we can tell you exactly how much you're going to spend every year. And then we're going to tell you exactly each year between now and death, what specific accounts to take those dollars from. And it doesn't work that way. We're still waiting for the software program to be created that does that. They've already named the software program. They just don't have it yet. They named it Crystal Ball. Now, when they can come up with that, then maybe we can do what so many people think a retirement planner is going to be able to do for them. Instead, what retirement planning is about is trying to look at the trends of your portfolio, of your spending, of your minimum dignity floor, of your secure income, make some determinations of what we think you're going to need to cover your minimum dignity floor, your income shortages, put a reasonable plan in place for long-term care, get an idea of what your fund number is and encourage you to spend that during your go-go years. That to us is what retirement planning is. We can sometimes tell you at a 30, maybe not even 30,000 foot level, maybe a 15,000 foot level, what we think conceptually your tax planning strategy should be based on your tax planning window. Some of you are going to have a long window, might have 8, 12, 15 years between retirement and when your RMDs begin and your tax planning window generally closes. Others are going to have short 1 or 2 year period where there's not much we can do. You only got a couple of years. But during that tax planning window, we can't tell you today specifically what you're going to do each and every year. Instead, we might say something to the effect of, it appears to us that you should be able to do a withdrawal analysis every fall. It appears to us that conversions make sense. Your tax ordering number, is, you told us, is 102. You want the two of you to prioritize the couple situation and the beneficiary situation. I'm making this part up, folks. So based on that tax ordering number of 102, it appears annual conversions could make sense, but a lot's going to depend on future tax laws, how much income you earn during the year, what type of situation you're dealing with from a health standpoint. Do you have deductible health care expenses? Have they changed tax rules? Whatever. So instead, let's try to build up this liquidity account for you with one or two or more years of every conceivable expense covered, and you can access it with full liquidity and no tax implications, meaning money in the bank or money in a Roth. And spend from that, folks, and stop worrying about it throughout the year. Just spend from it. And then every fall, work with your tax planner or work with your financial planner, or if you're a client of ours, you work with us. And we figure every fall, how are we going to replenish that liquidity account? Should we pull any of next year's spending into this year, postpone the rest of this year's spending into next year, do it as a conversion, do it as a withdrawal? These are what we do annually.
Yep.
All right, I rambled on,
yep, and we're gonna
but I wanted them to understand.
Run real
this.
Quick
gotta
here, because I've got another meeting to head to. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Everybody take care, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.